Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights revealed new evidence, previously unpublished, that for the first time presents what happened in Rabaa from the official documents of the dispersal, documents that formed the basis for the only official investigation to have been conducted into this worst massacre in Egyptian modern history.
In Egypt, human rights advocates mark the 10th anniversary of the Rabaa massacre, when Egyptian forces opened fire on a sit-in where tens of thousands of people had camped out in Cairo to protest the ouster of Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi. Some 900 protesters were killed. We'll go to Cairo. Then a secret Pakistan cable documents U.S. pressure to remove Imran Khan as prime minister.
This document that we revealed shows for the first time how the U.S. used its influence to remove Imran Khan from power in 2022.
The Intercept's now published the secret cable, which reveals how the U.S. was upset by Imran Khan's position on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Then, the UN Security Council meets to discuss the Azerbaijani blockade in Nagorno-Karabakh and calls for the immediate reopening of the Lachin Corridor to allow for humanitarian aid for the roughly 120,000 people suffering severe shortages. A report by former International Criminal Court prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo finds the blockade amounts to a likely genocide.
Let me say exactly what they say. The crime of genocide could be creating condition of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction of a group for ethnic reasons. That is a genocide. And that's exactly what happened there, because the blockade of the Lachin Corridor has a purpose to starve these people.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from the devastating Maui fires has reached 111 and continues to rise as crews search areas in and around Lahaina. About 1,000 people remain missing. On Wednesday, authorities in Hawaii defended not activating emergency sirens during the wildfire. This is Maui Emergency Chief Permanandaya.
The sirens, as I had mentioned earlier, is used primarily for tsunamis, and that's the reason why many of them are found, almost all of them are found, on the coastline. The public is trained to seek higher ground in the event that the siren is sounded. In fact, on the website of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, the following guideline is provided. If you are in a low-lying area near the coastline, evacuate to high grounds.
Instead of using the sirens, emergency officials in Maui sent out warnings to people's cell phones, but many did not receive the messages because the power and cell service was already down. Meanwhile, Hawaii's governor, Josh Green, has proposed a moratorium on land transactions in Lahaina. He said, quote, "My intention from start to finish is to make sure that no one is victimized from a land grab." Hawaiians have been warning about wealthy outsiders attempting to buy up land after the fire. Authorities in Canada have ordered all residents of the city of Yellowknife to evacuate as a massive wildfire approaches. Military aircraft will help evacuate some residents who cannot drive out of the city, which is the capital of Canada's Northwest Territories. The city is home to about 20,000 people. Yellowknife Mayor Rebecca Alty spoke Wednesday.
There is a possibility that without rain, the fire reaches the outskirts of Yellowknife by the weekend. It is approaching, but there's time to complete the community evacuation. It's being called now so that we can allow people the opportunity to drive while the highway is open. The highway is subject to closures at any time, but it's likely that it'll be open until tomorrow morning. Conditions will be smoky, and residents should drive with caution and care.
A number of other communities in Canada's Northwest Territories have already been evacuated due to the fires. So far this year, fires have burned more than 33 million acres in Canada, more than double any previous season. That's an area equivalent to the size of Alabama or nine Connecticuts. Here in the U.S., a federal appeals court upheld restrictions on the abortion pill mifepristone, the most widely used method of abortion in the United States. The Fifth Circuit Court sided with the right-wing Texas judge and plaintiffs who argued the FDA improperly relaxed regulations on the pill to make it more accessible and that it should only be used up to 7 weeks into a pregnancy and only issued in person. But due to a previous stay issued by the Supreme Court, mifepristone will remain available for now under current regulations while the case proceeds. The Justice Department's expected to appeal the ruling to the Supreme Court. In other abortion news, Indiana blocked a doctor who provided an abortion to a 10-year-old rape survivor from receiving a prestigious award. Dr. Caitlin Bernard performed the abortion for the Ohio patient last year and spoke out about it to highlight the cruelty and real-world impact of banning abortion. She was reprimanded and fined $3,000. More than 60 asylum seekers are feared dead after a boat carrying migrants was found drifting near Cape Verde off the coast of West Africa. The boat left Senegal over a month ago with 101 people on board. Most of the passengers were from the same Senegalese fishing village. Officials believe the boat may have been headed to the Canary Islands, which is part of Spain. According to the Spanish group Walking Borders, at least 778 migrants have died this year attempting to reach the Canary Islands. Defense chiefs from the West African regional bloc ECOWAS are meeting today and tomorrow in Ghana to discuss a possible military intervention in Niger, where the military seized power last month. The Intercept is reporting U.S.-trained officers have been appointed to head five of Niger's eight regions under the new military junta. This comes as the United Nations is warning international sanctions could worsen a growing humanitarian crisis in Niger.
In Niger, our humanitarian colleagues are concerned about the potential impact of the ongoing crisis on the food security situation. Before the coup, over 3 million people were already severely food insecure, and according to the World Food Program, some 7.3 million food insecure people could see their situation worsen due to the unfolding crisis. Humanitarian exemptions to sanctions and border closures are required to avert a rapid deterioration of the food security and malnutrition situation.
In other news from Niger, at least 17 soldiers have been killed in an attack near the Mali border. In recent years, the region has seen a surge in violence by groups linked to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. In Libya, at least 55 people have been killed in the heaviest fighting between rival armed factions so far this year in Tripoli. Over 150 people were injured before a truce took hold on Wednesday. Libya's been in a state of crisis for over a decade since the 2011 NATO-backed operation to topple Muammar Gaddafi. In Sudan, the army's second in command has said a plan to end the deadly conflict needs to be negotiated and a caretaker government must be formed as the fighting between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces rages into its fifth month. The UN this week issued a dire warning as the number of refugees who crossed the Sudanese border topped 1 million. In a joint statement, UN agencies said, quote, time is running out for farmers to plant the crops that will feed them and their neighbors. Medical supplies are scarce. The situation is spiraling out of control, unquote. Reports of sexual violence have increased by 50% since the start of the fighting, though this is likely a significant undercount of the true toll. This is the spokesperson for the UN Refugee Agency.
Start of the conflict in Sudan on the 15th of April, over 4.3 million people have been forced to flee. This includes over 900,000 refugees and asylum seekers who fled to neighboring countries, and 195,000 South Sudanese forced to return to South Sudan. Within Sudan, over 3.2 million people have been internally displaced, including more than 187,000 refugees already residing in the country at the start of the crisis.
A high-ranking NATO official has apologized after publicly suggesting that Ukraine could give up some of its land as part of a way to end the war with Russia. Stan Jensen, the chief of staff to the NATO Secretary General, made his initial comment during a recent forum in Norway. He said, quote, I think that a solution could be for Ukraine to give up territory and get NATO membership in return, unquote. Officials in Ukraine blasted Jensen's comment. A woman in Texas has been arrested and jailed after threatening to kill federal judge Tanya Chutkan, who was overseeing the Donald Trump January 6th case. Security has been increased around Chutkan, a black woman who was appointed by President Obama and has issued some of the toughest sentences for January 6th rioters. Meanwhile, supporters of Donald Trump have posted online the purported names and addresses of the grand jury members in Georgia who voted to indict the former president and 18 co-defendants. The Fulton County Sheriff's Office has not said if any security precautions have been taken to protect the grand jurors. Meanwhile, Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis continues to face an onslaught of racist abuse online instigated by Donald Trump, who's repeatedly attacked her on the campaign trail, calling her a racist. On Wednesday, Fannie Willis, who's the first black woman to serve as Fulton County DA, proposed the Trump trial begin March 4th. A local prosecutor in Kansas has withdrawn the search warrant used by police to raid the Marion County Record newspaper. The raid sparked national condemnation. In a statement, the Marion County attorney said there was, quote, insufficient evidence for the police to raid and seize material from the newsroom and home of the paper's owner. Items seized included computers and cell phones and hard drives. They will now be returned. On Wednesday, the Marion County Record published its first edition since the raid. The banner headline on the front page read, seized but not silenced. This comes as the community prepares for the wake and funeral of Joanne Meyer, the paper's co-publisher. The 98-year-old longtime journalist died Saturday, one day after the police raid on her home. Her son said she died of stress. In North Carolina, Republican lawmakers in the state Senate and House have voted to override vetoes from Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and enact three bills targeting trans youth. One law bans gender-affirming care for youth. Another bans transgender girls and women from playing on sports teams in middle school, high school, and college. A third law restricts how gender identity is discussed in schools. It's been described as North Carolina's version of Florida's Don't Say Gay bill. The group Equality North Carolina decried the three new laws as a slate of hate. Hundreds of people marched to the school board of Miami-Dade County in Florida on Wednesday to protest changes to how black history is taught in Florida's schools. The new standards require students be taught about the benefits of slavery. One section of the curriculum states enslaved people, quote, develop skills which in some instances could be applied for their personal benefit, unquote. Florida Governor, Republican presidential candidate Ron DeSantis, has defended the new curriculum changes. Speakers at Wednesday's rally included Tennessee State Representative Justin Pearson, who made national headlines when he and his colleague Justin Jones were expelled from Tennessee's Republican-dominated legislative body. They have since both won their seats back in the Tennessee legislature. And an emergency court hearing is continuing in Louisiana over calls for authorities to transfer children being imprisoned at the notorious maximum security Louisiana State Penitentiary known as Angola, which was built on a former slave plantation. Advocates say children as young as 14 years old are being held in solitary confinement and are being deprived of their education. Most of the children are black boys. This is Alana Odoms, executive director of the ACLU of Louisiana.
Children are currently being locked away in cages at Angola. Children, not youth offenders, not juvenile delinquents, not throwaways, not people without value. Children are children. Children are being deprived of an education. Children are being deprived of humane conditions. Children are being shackled and handcuffed.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. It's so wonderful to be back here in the studio with you, Amy, after more than 3 years.
It's absolutely amazing to be sitting side by side with you, Nermeen. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. And welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show in Egypt, where human rights advocates are marking the 10th anniversary of the Rabah massacre. It was August 14, 2013, when Egyptian forces opened fire on a sit-in where tens of thousands of people had camped out in Cairo to protest the ouster of Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi. Human Rights Watch estimates over 900 protesters were killed in what the group has described as the, quote, worst single-day killing of protesters in modern history. No one has been held responsible over the past 10 years. The Minister of Defense at the time was Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who's ruled Egypt for nearly a decade and is a close U.S. ally. Under el-Sisi, Egypt is now jailing about 60,000 political prisoners. This is Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdul-Quddus in 2013 on our live broadcast the day after the massacre, describing what he saw.
Yesterday was, a day of violence and chaos and bloodshed, the most violent episode that I've witnessed as a reporter in Egypt for the past 2.5 years. Walking around Nasr City, which is the northeastern neighborhood in Cairo where the Rabah al-Adawiyah Mosque was located, you could hear the crackle of machine gun fire intermittently in the air. There was tear gas on the outskirts and in the sit-in that mixed with black smoke rising from tires set alight by the protesters. You know, the Interior Ministry had spoken for a couple of weeks about the plan to disperse the sit-in that would go in stages and first involve surrounding the protesters and then a gradual escalation. But by all accounts, all the witnesses I spoke to said the attack started sometime around 6:30 and came in very hard with tear gas, and the casualties started pouring in, most of them with live ammunition, very soon after that. The scene inside the main medical facility in Rabah was extremely tragic. People were being brought in, the dead and wounded, every few minutes. The floor was slippery with blood. The windows were closed to prevent tear gas from coming in, and it was almost unbearably hot. And the dead were everywhere. And in one room alone, I counted 24 bodies just strewn on the ground, packed so closely you couldn't even walk in. On another floor, another 30, and another floor, another 8. Doctors were overwhelmed with the casualties. So it was a very difficult situation, and one that I think will have deep implications for Egypt's future, not just for years, but for decades to come.
That was Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdel-Quddus in 2013 on our live broadcast, the day after what has become known as the Rabah massacre. For more, we go to Cairo Now, 10 years later, to speak with Hossam Bagat, the founder and executive director of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, EIPR, based in Cairo. They've obtained a leaked copy of a government report on the massacre that implicated Egyptian authorities in the mass killing. It accused security forces of, quote, indiscriminate and disproportionate use of live ammunition, and concluded, quote, the largest number of Rabah victims were innocent civilians who were most likely peaceful demonstrators. Hossam Bagat also worked as an investigative journalist for the independent outlet Manamasr. He's been banned from traveling outside of Egypt and had his personal assets frozen. We interviewed him last at the UN climate summit in Sharm el-Sheikh. He couldn't leave Egypt, but he was able to address the folks that were there. Hossam, it's great to see you again. Can you talk about the significance of what this report is? Who did this report within the Sisi government and what exactly it found?
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be back. This is a very significant document, not just because of the conclusions it reached and the recommendations that it put forward, but because it is actually the only official inquiry that has been conducted for the last 10 years into this massacre. Obviously, in 2013, after the military takeover, the military authorities at the time did not have any interest in launching this inquiry. But for 6 months, they were under a lot of pressure to do something, not in order to establish accountability, but in order to avoid an international investigation or universal jurisdiction, accountability, or personal liability. So at the time, they set up this official commission, and it had six members, most of them judges. Most significantly, the Secretary General was appointed to that committee to lead its day-to-day work and take responsibility for the drafting of the report, is currently President Sisi's Minister of Justice. Of course, because of the damning conclusions of the report, although the report does fault both sides and does go out of its way to also blame the protesters, blame the leaders of the protest, blame basically everyone, it still could not avoid really reaching the conclusion that there was no safe passage, that this was an overwhelmingly peaceful protest, that the majority of those killed were peaceful protesters, not armed elements, as the government has been claiming for the last 10 years, and that the shootings were not precisely aimed and at times really were indiscriminate and definitely disproportionate with the threat to life, even if it were true. But the most important and the most damning conclusion there is that the committee actually heard official testimony from the field commander of the operation, who at the time was the director of special operations in the Interior Ministry. And he gave official affidavit where for the very first time he says on the record that peaceful alternatives to dispersing the sit-in were considered and abandoned before the operation. This is the first time that we get this official admission, and they actually identify things like, cutting off electricity and water or allowing protesters to leave the protest but not to go back in, etc. And in the end, they say that they chose to send the anti-riot forces and to implement the dispersal in 1 day as opposed to the three-month plan that had been considered and disregarded. This is the most important conclusion of this report. The report, of course, was never published for the last 9 years now, since it was handed over to President Sisi, who is pictured receiving the report. And we're not surprised, because the key recommendation in that report is calling for a full judicial investigation. This is a committee that was formed only with a very limited mandate of collecting evidence, hearing testimonies, analyzing events. It did not have the right to subpoena evidence or state officials, and it did not have the authority to refer cases to trial or assign responsibility. And therefore, their conclusion was that this is not enough. Our work is not enough. There needs to be a full judicial investigation. This is the recommendation that was never made public. It was actually omitted from the executive summary that was published 9 years ago. And now we know why. The regime, of course, has had 10 years to hold people to account. Instead, it did not even question a single officer, soldier, or state official as suspects in these killings. And instead, it arrested, prosecuted, and convicted over 700 of those protesters that survived the massacre, the vast majority of whom are currently in prison still 10 years later, serving life sentences, with at least 12 people on death row having lost their final appeal.
So, Hossam, could you elaborate on the enduring effects of both the crackdown and, as you point out, this reigning culture of impunity whereby no one has been held accountable? Amnesty International as well has said that the last 10 years can only be described as, quote, a decade of shame. The Rabah massacre was a turning point, following which the Egyptian authorities have relentlessly pursued a zero-tolerance policy of dissent. So if you could talk about that, the continuing crackdown on dissent and, in fact, its intensification after the massacre 10 years ago.
Of course. I mean, again, as we last discussed when we were in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt has been going through this unprecedented human rights crisis. And you can really trace the origins of this crisis to the day of the massacre. The massacre established a new normal where it's not just that hundreds of people could be killed within 12 hours in broad daylight in the presence of local and international media without a single person being held accountable, but it's also that it happened with popular support. And this is really, for me, for us, the reason this has been a decade of shame, is that overwhelmingly there was no outcry. There was there was no active involvement from the population, but there was certainly a degree of acceptance, admittedly, resulting from months of dehumanization and propaganda campaigns, but ultimately, we did not say not in our name, because it was a moment when people decided that it's okay for their rights and freedoms to be suspended, and that, the leader knows best and that we're going to let him thrive. And now the Egyptian people are again overwhelmingly waking up to the result of this bad deal, poisonous deal that they made, because they allowed one person to rule for 10 years with no free press, with no opposition parties, no parliamentary oversight, no judicial oversight, no public demonstrations on the streets, and no civil society. And look at where it got us now, the worst economic crisis in Egypt's history, with no prospect for improvement, with actually expectations for things to get worse, with a leader that is refusing to take responsibility for any of it, and increasing daily suffering. So for the first time today, people are waking up to the fact that they agreed to the terms of this deal, and that it was to their detriment, not just to the detriment of the victims that were most immediately targeted.
And Hossam, how have people in Egypt responded to this report? And also explain, how is the position, what is the position now of members of the Muslim Brotherhood or people who were previously supported Morsi?
The findings of the report came as a shock. And for the last 3 days, of course, it's been the topic of discussion on social media, because, media traditional media and even websites have been completely, nationalized by Sisi. It's coming as a shock for particularly two segments of, the audience. First is people who really believe the propaganda 10 years ago and, stop thinking about the massacre, its repercussions for the last few years, and are only now able to read what happened not from reports of independent journalists or civil society investigators, but from a report of a government